Welcome, Red Ice members. Thank you for tuning in. Very nice to have you along. We are continuing our very interesting conversation with Jeff Stray from diagnosis2012.co.uk and, of course, the author of Beyond 2012, Catastrophe or Ecstasy. And I want to begin this segment to talk a little bit more about crop circles and the connection to 2012. I know that there have been in the recent years, I guess, a few different crop circles here and there that have allegedly some kind of connection to 2012. Some have said some crop circles resemble Mayan glyphs. We have others that potentially are implying that there is an alignment that seems to point to 2012. I think that the one was this season, actually. And of course, Jeff, you mentioned the very interesting connection between these plasma balls or ball lightning or whatever you want to call them. I mean, I've seen this video basically where we see two plasma balls going out over a field and basically laying out this crop circle. Obviously, very difficult to say if it's real or not, but heck, it's a really impressive video. Have you seen that one, Jeff?
Yes, that's quite a controversial one, that, because I mean, this has really split the crop circle world into two camps. The guy who made the video, I believe his name was John Whaley. I mean, you may have heard some of this before, but it turned out that he was involved. His job was in the video making industry, and so people became very skeptical about it. And I think he's actually done a video confession somewhere that he hoaxed it. But then,
really,
there are other people that are convinced that he was persuaded to do that, and that it wasn't a hoax. And because the fact is, he showed it that evening in the barge in on his camera, as if it had just, you know, he just filmed it on his video camera.
Right.
A friend of mine who works in the video industry said that to do the amount of what he calls high-end changes would require, well, a high-end kit, he said, in order to work on it at home on a computer. He just didn't think there was enough time between its being found and him turning up in the pub for him to have done that.
But, right.
So I don't know. I mean, as you say, it's a very impressive bit of video. And the fact is, I have Andy Thomas, who's the guy who runs that crop circle group that I joined back in 97. Him and Barry Reynolds, who also used to help him run it, they went to interview a couple called the Tomlinsons, who were eyewitnesses to a crop formation appearing on the South Downs. And during that experience, this, I can't remember if she said it was a ball of light or a whirlwind now, because it varies. I think it was probably a whirlwind. As it came, it came right past them, this thing. Had formed just a fairly simple crop formation, and came past them, and it made such a loud noise that it actually physically broke her eardrums.
Hmm.
So, I mean, she was in no doubt at all that this was a real phenomenon, because it had a quite a dramatic physical effect on her by shattering her eardrums. And I myself have spoken to, I gave a girl a lift down in Wiltshire once, who lived on a farm, and she told me that she'd seen one of these appearing in the daytime, just as a sort of like a little mini whirlwind going through the grass, staying still for a minute, then shooting off. And she went over, and there was a little crop formation. So there is a real phenomenon here. And how many of these are, you know, I mean, obviously there are teams of hoaxers out there who are getting quite good at it now.
Sure.
You know, I think there's still a core phenomenon there of, I mean, that one that appeared on the top of Milk Hill, where there was over 400 circles a few years ago, that, to me, is just, I showed that picture to somebody. This was like a neighbour that I hadn't met before, actually. It was just, the phone rang, and it was someone who rang up about crop circles, and I came back and said, oh, that was so-and-so talking about crop circles, and they said, oh, yeah, that's that. Those things where those two guys did it with planks of wood, isn't it? I said, well, actually, have you seen this? And I got this photograph out and showed him a photograph of this formation. It filled the entire field on top of Milk Hill, over 400 circles, and his legs very nearly gave way underneath him as he looked to grab onto something. Oh my God, it's actually, that can't be man-made. He just said it just couldn't be, because it was so, to make that in one night, they actually worked it out that it would have to be under 30 seconds for each circle to be made in less than 30 seconds for the amount of darkness there was between dusk and dawn. And I know a guy who was camped in fact, I've met two people who were camped on the edge of that field that night, and it was pouring down with rain and blowing a gale, and there's no way they could have even put their heads out the door. Hmm. And yet there was no footprints in it when they came out of the tents in the morning. It was pristine. There's this core of a real phenomenon there. Yeah, definitely.
Is this the one with like six arms spiraling out, and it's incredibly many circles? It's almost kind of slightly twisted. And this popped up in, let's see here, looking at a picture, 17th of August 2001. Do you know if that's the one?
Yeah, that's the one. That is the one, yes.
Interesting, yeah.
It's a sort of Julius set. I mean, mathematically, I don't think it is a Julius set, but it's like a multiple version of the single, one of those single arms is called a Julius set, and one of those appeared at Stonehenge a few years previously. Mm. They say in a 45-minute time window in the daytime. Hmm. So there's about three witnesses from different places who said it wasn't there, particularly a pilot who flown one way and then flew back again.
Interesting. One can't help to kind of speculate a little bit then, because again, which you're connecting a few very interesting dots here. If we think about the research of the Russian guy you mentioned, Alexei Dmitry, and his idea about these balls or plasma or some kind of energy coming in, entering into our solar system.
It fits in very well with. I mean, ever since the early 90s, there's been a group of scientists in Michigan. Well, it's basically Levengood, William Levengood, is the main biophysicist who's been doing the study, and he's been assisted by John Burke and Nancy Talbot. And they call themselves BLT, Burke, Levengood, Talbot. And they've looked at the... I mean, people have sent them... it's all done with the proper protocol, where they take samples at measured distances across the formation and a control sample from the edge of the field, and they found anomalies that most of these anomalies Levengood hadn't seen them in his entire career as a biophysicist, and that includes exploded nodes, where the actual lumpy bit on the stem where the moisture is concentrated, that has exploded outwards, so all the sap sort of comes out there. In some cases where the node hasn't exploded, they look at it under a microscope and they find that the actual pores have enlarged. They've found in looking at the seeds from across the formation, they found in many cases the seeds are either completely sterile and won't grow anything, or they have an accelerated growth rate. And out of that, the team actually developed a patent on a method of improving fertility of seeds, and they did that by, well, I mean, it's not known exactly what that process is, but I think it involves microwave radiation, because what they found was that a way of replicating this exploding node was to put a bunch of these stalks in an industrial microwave, and the flash heating in a microsecond causes the moisture in those nodules to turn to steam and either burst its way out by making a hole or make these microscopic pores larger.
Right.
So basically, over the years of looking at these anomalies, there's several other anomalies as well that they found, but putting them all together, they were looking for something. They'd found another major anomaly they found was melted meteoritic particles, which are concentrated more in the center of the formation, and they're melted into microscopic spheres.
Yes.
Now, there's a hoaxer called Rob Irving who claimed to have done all that by getting hold of these this spherical particles and going around formations sprinkling them, but that actually doesn't explain. They found them in a huge number of formations from about six different countries. It doesn't really explain, I mean...
All of it?
No. So they were looking for something that might explain the presence of those particles, microwave, something with a microwave side effect and something with a swirling effect. And what they found was they discovered independently from some other researchers that about 80% of these formations are found on aquifers, that is rocks that are very porous, like limestone, greensand, and sandstone. Mm-hmm. And that has a quality where water trickles slowly through it and creates an electrical charge. So it's a little bit like a lightning conductor effect where, I mean, lightning is a high-energy plasma that comes down from the ionosphere, or comes down from cloud level, rather. They were looking for something like that, which would be attracted to this aquiferous geology. Mm. And they discovered that there is such a thing as what they call sprites, which are plasma tubes that come down from the ionosphere, usually above a thunderstorm, right above the storm. They haven't been observed coming right down to ground level, but they theorized that some phenomena like this, or phenomenon, singular, must be a sort of plasma tube. If a plasma tube was to come down from the ionosphere to as far as ground level, it would have the qualities, it would have the side effect of microwave radiation, it would have the swirling, it have the heat, which would cause the softening of the crop so it bends, and the as well as that microwave effect. Mm. And it would also bring down, a lot of the meteoritic particles are gathered up in the ionosphere, so it would bring them down and concentrate them in these formations, and the heat would melt them into little spheres. This was the idea. So they seem to have got the beginnings of an explanation, but they then went on to quite a complex development of that, where they a little bit like the way that in a snowflake you can get various kinds of pattern. Mm-hmm. There are various, in this whole process, there are various criteria that that depending on the atmospheric conditions vary in their quantities. And so in the different quantities of those various criteria, that would cause the different patterning that we get. But to me, that's not a very good explanation, because these patterns are meaningful to people. And I mean, as you know, they've read all kinds of things into it, and there are sacred patterns from all sorts of different cultures that bring in all sorts of people into this whole crop circle phenomenon, and it springs out in all sorts of different ways, and sort of gets them interested. It brings people in from all walks of life into the sort of whole paranormal field, and it seems to me that there must be some sort of an intelligence involved at that point, where, and this is where the idea that these balls of light are involved, because, as I said, there is some evidence that they could be a transient life form that Dmitriev says it's a form between our world and the next world. It's a sort of, it's an interworld process, and that because there may be these consciousnesses out there that are having a job impacting on this level of reality, that they can attach themselves to these balls of light and then, you know, communicate with us via these patterns, these meaningful patterns.
What do you think that they are here at this particular time? Is there a connection to 2012 here then, do you think?
Well, I do, actually, yeah. It all seems to fit in. In fact, there was the ex-editor of UFO Reality, John King, had an abduction experience in which he was told this basically back in the early 80s, before the whole thing had really taken off, that there was a sort of triangular area of the West Country of England where a lot of these aquifers are concentrated there, because you've got several lines of hills that all meet. You've got the Chilterns, the Quantocks, and the Mendips. I think there's another line as well. They all sort of seem to meet in the area that meets up around Avebury, which is the sort of, they don't all get that far, but they all point to that area. Mm-hmm. There you have basically the middle of this whole phenomenon is sort of based around Avebury. I mean, in John King's message that he was given, it was Barbary Castle Hillfort, which is just north of Avebury. Mm-hmm. But he said that these things, he wasn't quite sure what he was talking about when he came through it out with this prophecy, but it became apparent that this is the area in which the crop circles were concentrated, and that the whole thing was to be a prelude to a decloaking of the vehicles in which the beings that are making these are travelling. Hmm. I mean, whether those... when it comes down to actually talking about whether these beings, according to John King's information, are, you know, ETs or not,
right?
This is where it gets a bit weird, because it's like they're more like extra-dimensional than extraterrestrial, because it seems like when you get on to this dimension where they live, or density level, you know, the relationship between place and it alters, because somehow, you know, what we would see as an impossible travelling on this dimension is completely different on that dimension. It's sort of they exist in the same place in the same time. Time and space is all completely different on that level, according to what he brought through. Anyway,
I was just going to mention, as we were cut off, that basically what you were saying is that this is an entity that is living allegedly beyond any kind of... according to the properties that we know in this universe, and hence travel or time or anything like that, that those types of properties actually are kind of dissolved. You know, that's the message that I get from this. Maybe you wanted to expand more on that.
Yeah, this is where the messages that come in through from, particularly from people who've had near-death experiences, of which I now know of six people who've specifically come back from these NDEs talking about 2012. A sort of a subtext that runs through the prophecies and through the NDE pronouncements about what is going on here is that in 2012 there will be a breach of our perceptual boundaries. If you look at the prophecies of the Maoris, for example, that's a very good example, because they have this creation myth that says... in the beginning of time, in at creation, we had a sky god and an earth god, one on top of the other in an embrace. As a result of the embrace, they had three children, three gods, who pushed them apart. So that's why the sky is up there and the earth is down here. And then it goes on. The second part of the prophecy is that one day when the children of the war god, that is mankind, when we are too distracted to remember the old myths anymore, then the sky god and the earth god will come crashing back together, and they call it Kahinga Tiarai. And that actually translates as the curtain will fall. So, I mean, on a basic level, that sounds like bad news and that it's game over situation. But one of the young Maoris actually spoke to the elders, and it transpired that two of these words have mutated over the years from their original meanings, and that is the word for curtain and the word for fall should originally have been veil and dissolve. So that word veil is the same word they've got for the veil between life and death. So in 2012, this is when they've pinpointed this change, the veil between life and death will dissolve. And that fits on exactly with what the Peruvians say in their Pachacuti prophecy. They say that in Tarapé Pacha, which they put as the 1st of August 2012, this is the golden age of meeting ourselves again. They say at this point, in a shamanic cosmos, you have an overworld and an underworld, and the everyday world in between them, connected up by the world tree, up and down which the shamans travel, which corresponds to the Earth's polar axis.
Yes.
They say that the underworld and the overworld in 2012 will converge on the everyday world. So you have, again, this idea that these other realms will become accessible to us.
Huh.
And when you think about it, that brings in prophecies of the reappearing of Shambhala, which is also, there's a whole group of people who think that Kalki is alive on the earth today. Kalki is the Hindu name for Rudra Kakrian, who's the Tibetan lama in charge of Shambhala, the last of a series of lamas who each live 100 years and are in charge of the city. And the last one will bring in the golden age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so he, according to the theory, 1926 is when he took over. So we're getting quite close to the point where his time is up, and that, and this golden age has to occur. And that, at that time, the hidden city of Shambhala will become visible. So again, you have this invisible realm becoming accessible to us.
Do you think that this has anything to do with, you know, not maybe that the dead will rise again, because that seems too much kind of a zombie flick to me, but the idea of communicating perhaps then with spirits, a soul, a person that has left the earthly realms, do you think that that is a possibility, that that will open up then?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because just this week I saw some photographs on the net of some flooding that's occurred, and all these coffins have come floating out onto the surface in a graveyard. So it's like this graveyard's littered with coffins. It just sort of reminded me of that whole concept. And there's one of the tarot cards where you can see these coffins have broken open and these people are coming out.
Yes, yes.
But that whole idea is basically pinched from the Egyptians. I mean, many of our the Christian concepts really come from Egyptian concepts, and the whole concept of judgment and this idea. I mean, this is why the Egyptians mummified themselves and put all their stuff in the grave. They thought, you know, they had a false door as well for the astral body, the ba and the ka to come in and out. This whole idea of coming out of our coffins really has come from them, I think. But yeah, I do think it seems to be saying that we are going to have some sort of communication possibilities. I mean, it's again bringing in a certain amount of speculation. But I mean, you've got in the Christian tradition, you've got this idea that at the what they call the judgment day,
yes,
the heavenly Jerusalem will descend. So that's like an invisible city becoming visible. And in the Peruvian Paititi prophecy, again, you have, when the Golden Age starts, you have the appearance of the invisible kingdom of Paititi becomes visible. So it does seem like that there's going to be some sort of connect-up. And in fact, there is a direct connection here with one of the Maya prophecies from the Chilambalams, where it says, this is the Jaguar priest prophecies. They were actually written down after the Spanish had arrived, where they actually made a bonfire of all the material they could find. And then Delanda had to, he was told off by the King of Spain and had to go back and encourage them to write down some of their knowledge. So one of the results was these Chilambalam prophecies, the Jaguar priest prophecies.
Right.
There's some talking in the Chilambalams of the nine gods, and how they are. It talks of how they're due to return, and it talks about the return of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent god. But it also says the god will come to visit his little ones, and after death will be the subject of his discourse. That's pretty well exact quote of the translation from my memory. So to me, that seems to tie in with, because all these people are coming back from near-death experiences talking about it, it seems one possibility is that everybody will have something that equates to a near-death experience. Well, it's been found now. Have you heard about Rick Strassman's work?
That's the spirit molecule, right? DMT?
That's right, yes. He looked into the pineal gland and found that at birth and at death and during mystical experiences, our pineal gland secretes a hallucinogen, dimethyltryptamine, into the bloodstream. But it transpires that there are probably at least five hallucinogenic molecules produced by the pineal gland under certain circumstances. But dimethyltryptamine is the one that covers all these altered states of consciousness I mentioned, where people are coming back talking about 2012. What ties them all together is DMT, because they're all mystical experiences. Therefore, everybody who's had them was had this DMT in their bloodstream. And also, it's now known that the Maya themselves had they used a hallucinogenic toad well, the venom from a toad that contains 5-MeO DMT, very, very similar. And they use the same mushroom that McKenna's, and their ceiba tree actually contains harmine, the other in its bark. It was the other main constituent of the ayahuasca brew.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Could it be what you're saying here a little bit? What I'm hearing is that potentially, if everyone is having a near-death experience or close to it, or even dies, I mean, could this have something to do then that we could actually enter into a phase that is very apocalyptic in nature, meaning that all souls on the planet, so to speak, are actually in one way or another, are going to come into contact with the realm of the dead, so to speak?
Well, I mean, if you look at Boris Moraviev, his work, this is one of Gurdjieff's contemporaries, he implied that all souls will be incarnation at this point. We've got to the point where everybody who's born will come back again and actually be, for that moment, incarnate.
And that's why we're so many on the planet right now, right?
Well, it seems to fit with that, yes.
Yeah.
It seems... Now, what was I going to say? The near-death experiences. Yeah, I know what it was, yeah. The in our sinus bones and in our pineal gland, we have magnetite. And it's a fact that some people are electromagnetically hypersensitive, such that if there's little fluctuations in the Earth's geomagnetic field, that will cause them to have visions. People with temporal lobe epilepsy and schizophrenia are examples.
Mm.
And when there's a solar storm, and remember that NASA has now confirmed that 2012 is going to be a pretty significant solar storm, equivalent to one we haven't had for some considerable time.
It is.
That
yep.
will then cause a geomagnetic storm on the Earth, and that will affect people who are electromagnetically hypersensitive by causing them to have visions. I mean, that is in the Bible about these times as well, isn't it? About your old men will dream dreams and see visions. I can't remember the exact quote.
Right.
But I don't like to quote the Bible too much.
So what you're saying here, Jeff, is that we can tell, basically you're laying out very many different types of points, so to speak, both scientific and both NDEs, near-death experiences, and that all of these things together seem to point again towards the same time frame, same event, if you will. And I want to tie this back with the idea and talk a little bit more actually about the sunspot cycle. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think personally that's a key point to all of this, a key element to what is going to happen potentially in 2011, 2012, something like that, leading up to that end date. And what you've been adding here only further strengthens my belief that that's going to be very significant. And we could have obviously technology disrupted, we know that, but what you're saying here as well is that we could have an increase in people's sensitivity. CMEs, the coronal mass ejections from the sun, will potentially come, flood us with more energy, so to speak, cosmic energy. And also we can add on top of that, if this plasma you were talking about earlier that is outside right now, at least the heliosphere of the sun, if this also penetrates within our solar system, we could also be flooded with this energy, with this plasma, right? Because the sun is bursting this towards our planet, you know? So that's a possible scenario here.
Yeah, Dmitriev said that he thinks that this flooding of plasma will cause the mass spontaneous evolution of humanity as we now know it. But he also said that the Earth, there is evidence now. I mean, remember, he is a geologist. That the Earth itself there is evidence that it's in the throes of geomagnetic inversion. In other words, the poles are actually shifting positions. The acceleration of the poles is going up every year, the movement of the poles, and the actual strength of the background field is lessening and has been doing for around 2,000 years, as far as I know. And the third thing, which they've actually modelled this in the laboratory, and those were two things that would happen just before a pole reversal. And the other thing was you get little outbursts of the opposite field in little bubbles, and there is actually one of those off the coast of South Africa.
Okay.
So it looks as if, you know, we're looking at an imminent geomagnetic reversal. And this is where the prophecies that came through from Danny and Brinkley tie in, because Danny and Brinkley was probably the most well-known of the near-death experiences. And he was given a series of visions of the future, 300 visions there were, 117 of them were major world events. And by the time around 2000 or so, there was only 17 of those left to be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And what he said about, I mean, that included Chernobyl explosion and the fall of the Berlin Wall among those 117. What he said about 2012 was that his prophecies basically went up from 1975 when he died while on the telephone and a lightning bolt hit the phone line.
Right, yes.
He was dead for 28 minutes and he woke up with a sheet over him on the way to the morgue, having the death certificate having been issued. But when he recovered, of course, he said these prophecies ended in a few that said between 2011 and 2012, the Earth changes would ramp up. You know, the atmospheric and magnetic changes on the planet will start to increase. Uh-huh. And he said that in 2012, there would be an evolutionary opportunity for mankind that is caused by the solar system being in a position where it's where it's open to a new kind of a new energetic, I can't remember the exact words now, a new energetic combination, something like that. But mm-hmm. It sounds like he's describing exactly what Dimitri is talking about with the solar system going into a plasma cloud.
Right. Yeah, I mean, do you think that we have, the first of all, we can mention, of course, if we have such a thing as a polar reversal, I think that basically means that all human electronics will go bust, as far as I know. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Probably.
Probably.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know if we had an electromagnetic pulse wave, that's the kind of thing that will happen. Vehicles with electronic boxes on them will probably fail. I mean, it's not a good time to be in an aeroplane.
Right.
And yes, possibly burn out computer hard drives, as far as I know.
Yes. One thing that we talked about here then is that the polar reversal might imply that electronics will fail. Another thing that comes to mind, of course, is that do you think that human beings will have to prepare in some way? Will this be a very spiritual shift, or will this be a very physical shift, meaning that we have to, you know, prepare for this in some way, and will we potentially again stand at the edge of our own extinction?
Okay. I'll just finish what I was saying about what Brinkley said.
Right.
Basically, that he also predicted between 2012 and 2014 a reversal of the poles. So that fits in with everything else as well.
Right.
But, yes, regarding how we should prepare ourselves, I think we are looking at something which, I mean, this is something that another what saying of McKenna, that if you look at this as a birth process, that if an alien was to come around the corner and see a woman giving birth, he thinks she was in the throes of a very painful death with a mestetization of a huge tumor. Hmm. But in fact, the reverse would be the truth. And there is some evidence that you can look at this as a birth process, because if you look at the Maya calendar systems, the Dzogchen calendar, which is a 260-day calendar, is said by the Maya, the ones that have been using it for thousands of years in the highlands of Guatemala, say, this is based on human gestation. That's why it's 260 days.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't seem to be obvious to the anthropologists what cycle this was. So they asked why 260 days, and they said that when a woman misses a period, there's 260 days before the baby's due.
Right.
So it happens to be a fact that if you use that, if you set that out as a grid structure, and then you can use that same grid structure to map out the 13 Bacton cycle of the long count, and that's the one that started in 3114 BC and ends in 2012. And that also consists of 260 units, but this time each square is not a day, but a katun, a period of 7,200 days, just under 20 years. So something that Arguelles suggested in The Mind Factor, which was, I think, his best, most amazing contribution, is that if you notice that the beginning of the turning back to the cycle around 3114 BC was the beginning of history. It's the first phases of civilization, the first dynasties of Egypt, the building of the megaliths, the first phases of Stonehenge. So you can use that as a sort of map of human history, and that implies that somehow 2012 is the end of human history, and that after that it's post-historic, and that the whole thing maps out a planetary gestation, like a mega map of the individual gestation of the Tzolk'in. So that, if this is a, you could look upon the whole thing as a sort of, this is when Peter Russell's ideas come into play as well, because he pointed out that there are 10 to the power of 10, that's 10,000 million molecules in a human neuron. Mm-hmm. And there are 10 to the power of 10 neurons in a human neocortex. And we're now above 10 to the 9, approaching 10 to the 10 humans on the planet. And so when you approach this magic number, it's a sort of critical mass factor. And so the individual units start to behave as parts of a larger organ or a larger being. So right. You could look upon this transition point that we're approaching as the point where we become living neurons in a global brain as of an awakening Earth.
Well, that's
and
that's
that also ties in, with what the, it seems to, all these things tie in various ways to various different prophecies.
Yes.
The Peruvian people, the Quero, say that when we are functioning as we should, we act like a sort of conducting rod between the sky and the earth. And one of the exercises they do is to imagine themselves as a conducting rod with light going through their bodies. And that ties in the whole concept of Kundalini, which connects up Kundalini Shakti of the earth and Shiva from above.
So human beings potentially are an intermediary in some way. We're part of the planet, we're of the planet in that sense, and could it be also that the planet needs us then in that regard? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's been preparing us to perform our true evolutionary function as living human cells in a global brain, where, I mean, we have the net, but I think it's probably designed for a telepathic link up.
Right.
And that's exactly what Daniel Brinkley found when he came back from his NDE, as do many people who come back, that people who got within his aura, he thought they were speaking to him, but then he realized he was hearing their thoughts. It was actual audible telepathy going on. And it took him some time to get to grips with it.
Sorry to interrupt there, but I find that very interesting, because, again, his particular experience was that he had lightning coming through him, meaning he had an incredible electrical charge, basically activating him, if you will. And what we've been talking about here before that is that potentially we're having huge amounts of energy coming in, plasma or something like that. That would potentially mean then that this is about the activation of everyone with the help of this plasma, this energy, what have you, and that will potentially radically change the human being so much that we will potentially enable that will enable us potentially to have these types of properties, like, for instance, telepathy.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about Patrick Gerrell. He's a kind of an apocalyptic writer, if you will. He writes written a book called How to Survive 2012, and also the Orion Prophecy. And he talks very much about basically that the world, as I understand it, at least, that the world will end in 2012. Now, you mentioned a little bit at the beginning that you have some other information that seems to not point in this direction. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. I'd like to hear that.
Yeah. Patrick sent me. We were communicating before he published his first book. We were emailing each other, and he sent me I think he may have even sent me the entire manuscript for comments and things, and I did point out several points to him, some of which were just pure typos, some of them which I thought were more serious mistakes. His story, have you had him on the show here?
No, I haven't, no.
Well, his story was he read the Mayan prophecies, the book by Adrian Gilbert and Maurice Cottrell, and he became convinced that the world was going to end in 2012, and he had some expensive life insurance policies that were all due to terminate shortly after 2012. So he got a bit, you know, his plans for his retirement were completely ruined. And so he cashed in the policies and spent the money doing research about how to cope with 2012. And he got hold of a translation of the Egyptian Book of the Dead by a Frenchman called Albert Slosman. And it actually makes more sense than the standard Budge translation, if you read it. It actually reads as common as a sensible sentences, unlike the one that most people use. But the interpretation was that the people who died in the Atlantis cataclysm had seen a sign in the sky shortly before that, so that they knew something was going to happen, and that the survivors of that cataclysm made their way to Egypt, and they sort of somehow managed to encode that information in Egypt for to be passed on to the people who would be facing the repeat performance of this catastrophe that caused Atlantis. So he said that there was a sign in the sky, and it had something to do with Orion, and he was looking at the retrograde loops of Venus that occur every 8 years. When the Earth comes alongside Venus, it appears to do this loop in the sky. Mm-hmm. And so, it's every 584 days, actually. Every 8 years, if you join up the points on the horizon where the five loops have happened, it forms a perfect pentagram.
Indeed.
So it's not quite. It's about 2.4 degrees off.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the next loop then moves around slightly. This Slosman said that this cataclysm in Atlantis occurred in 9792 BC, and that the sign of it was a retrograde loop of Venus occurring over the Orion constellation. And he looked at his astronomical software and found that, sure enough, in 2012, we have a retrograde loop of Venus occurring over the Orion constellation. So he thought this is the sign that this cataclysm is due for 2012. Mm,
yeah.
And then he was convinced that if this information was still existing and waiting for us to discover it, it must be in a building that the Greek philosophers referred to as the Labyrinth, which is a huge astronomical building with thousands of rooms, and no one's ever dug it up or investigated it or really found it. Mm. The idea was, you know, how Robert Bovell discovered that the belt stars of Orion correspond to the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau. If you superimpose Orion over them, the belt stars fit exactly on the three Giza pyramids.
Mm, yeah.
Well, Ratings and Gerald said that if you continue that process outwards, that it happens that there's a constellation called the Labyrinth, and that if you then look at where the Labyrinth overlays the land, when you've got the constellations locked in with the belt of Orion over the pyramids, then if you then go down from the celestial Labyrinth, you'll find the position of the terrestrial Labyrinth. And then he said that he'd done that and located this terrestrial Labyrinth at a place called Hawara, and that there were some signs around there that he was right, and this was exactly the place as described by the Greek philosophers, and that it was buried there, but it cost a lot of money to excavate it because it was below the water table.
Hmm.
Well, I started checking out some of these claims, and I realized when looking at the retrograde loops that because of this 2.4 degree difference in the pentagram, when it comes back after 8 years, it's actually exactly 8 mile halves, by the way. That's why they didn't have the two leap days we use, because they were using the 365 day halve calendar as a sort of check for the position of Venus. That's why, if you look at the date that we had the Venus transit into 2004, it was on the 8th of June, and in 2012 it's due on the 6th of June. So you've got this two-day difference, which is exactly 8 years minus the two leap days we put in. It's exactly 8 Maya Hubs.
Gotcha, yeah.
So I realised that this, if you map out the positions of these retrograde loops of Venus over Orion, you find that, well, every 8 Harbs, you get another one occurring over there with 2.4 degrees difference. So you've got a series of these retrograde loops positioned over Orion from about the 1920s through the present day and into the future. And so if you then use the some of this astronomical software and find the pattern that this made in the sky, the position, the exact position in 9792 BC, and look for a match, it actually matches up around 1920 to 1930 was the best match.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, according to that theory, the world should have come to an end then.
Already, okay. Hmm.
Yeah, and it didn't. And the second thing I checked up was I found a map of the Giza Pyramid area, and I superimposed the star map onto it so that the three belt stars matched up with the Giza Pyramids. Then I found the Labyrinth constellation in Hyades and superimposed it onto the ground, and it was absolutely in the wrong direction. It was actually about a mile north of the Giza Pyramids, where that if you superimpose the Labyrinth constellation onto the ground,
mm-hmm.
whereas the Hawara position where they said the Labyrinth was about 15 miles to the west of the pyramids. So it actually didn't match up at all. And then I realized that actually they hadn't discovered that position in Hawara, because there had been several Egyptologists going back to Flinders Petrie who'd sort of been presuming that that position at Hawara was where the labyrinth was, and they'd come up with various reasonings for that over the years, and various visits and studies. Various people had concluded that that was where it was. And just recently, actually, Gerald has inspired a team from a Belgian university to go to Egypt with ground-penetrating radar, and they seem to have confirmed, without a doubt, that Hawara is the position of the labyrinth. Now, good for him, because, you know, that's the first time that ground-penetrating radar has been used there, and it might end up in the place being excavated, and it may be he's right, and that it does contain information about that will be relevant to us in 2012. But the other part of the theory doesn't actually hang together, that this retrograde loop of Venus over Orion means the world's going to end in 2012. That mm-hmm. doesn't hold together. Nor does the positioning of the labyrinth, finding out the celestial labyrinth, position us with the terrestrial labyrinth, because that is a completely separate issue that's been implied by archaeologists already.
All right. And also then, as far as I understand it, this has to do with something that someone said in that regard. This has to do with the mythology of what the people from the alleged Atlantis said, you know, and passed on this knowledge down, that when this sign in the heavens basically again occurs, that's when this will happen again, right?
I mean, it could be a case of that he's intuited something and just in his search for confirmation of it has sort of jumped onto the wrong bit of information. And I mean, he may, and like a lot of people with these things, they intuit something. I mean, this has occurred to me that this is why that McKenna came up with the time wave, because it could be that he intuited the whole 2012 thing and then looked around for something to explain it, you know. And it may be that these ways we have of explaining it are not actually that relevant, but the most important thing is that they're concentrating us on that transition point, and that might be the most important factor.
Right. Well, it's interesting nonetheless, and I hope that the guys find something down there in Egypt and locate the labyrinth here on Earth. That would be a fantastic discovery, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. Yeah. In fact, yeah. So someone just sent me the link for this site this week.
Okay.
So it does look to be quite interesting what's going on down there.
Maybe you can pass it on to me, Jeff, and I can link this up in relation to this interview also as well, so people can take a look at it.
Okay.
Yeah.
The thing that actually kicked off Geralt's fear in the first place was reading the Mayan prophecies. And I found in there also that some of the... I mean, again, this may be another case, because it does seem something's going on with the sun. I mean, there's plenty of evidence. Mitch Batros is covering that a lot now.
Yes.
If you look at the general trajectory of sunspots over the years, that is going in an upward trajectory. We've just had a complete disappearance of them recently, haven't we?
Isn't that interesting? I think it's the most quiet, allegedly, as it's been in the last 100 years or something. It's incredibly quiet. Nothing at all is happening. So it's a little bit like the quiet before the storm, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, again, when it comes down to the details, I found checking out the details of how that was all worked out in the Mayan prophecies didn't really hang together, because the figures that they've got for working all these complex numbers out from, it all stems down to the periods of rotation of the equatorial and polar fields on the sun. There are four equatorial fields and two polar fields that rotate at different speeds, mm-hmm. causing the magnetic field lines to get tangled up and cause these sunspots to pop out on the surface.
Right.
When I tried to find confirmation for those figures, I used the nearest figures I could find, official figures for those rotational periods, and worked out the things which they've worked out in their book, and it came out as about a 1,000-year error when you multiply it up into the longest cycle.
Hmm.
So it didn't tie together on that level, but yet there does seem to be something going on with the sun.
Yes, yes, indeed. So, I mean, it's going to be very interesting just, keeping an eye on this, obviously, as we progress forward. I mean, 4 years, it's not that... long of a period away, and especially when things are moving so fast as they're doing now in regards to time, at least for me, and you mentioned it yourself at the beginning of this program, that things seem to be speeding up. So, I mean, it's going to be really interesting watching this. If you can, to begin to round things up here for the second segment, in a nutshell, I know it's very difficult, but if you can for us, what do you expect and what do you think will happen?
Right. Well, I mean, you said earlier to talk about how people could prepare for this. Well, I'm always ready to change my my favorite theory, if you like, when new information comes in. I think we've got to be flexible like that.
That's healthy.
Yeah, but my favorite theory at the moment, as you may have gathered, is that the Earth is going into this, and the whole solar system is going into this area of this dense plasma. That will kick off a series of things, including increased solar activity, that will also accelerate the Earth's magnetic reversal or movement, and cause the magnetic particles in our heads to kick in and give us an excretion of these internal hallucinogens. In other words, a lot of people will start to externalize their thoughts in a visible way. And for that reason, I think one of the important ways we can prepare is to confront our shadows, all that buried material which people put to the back of their mind, all that stuff that's influenced us throughout our lives and controls the way we react to people, is stuff that is unresolved, and that, if it's not resolved, will come out in a visible form and confront us.
Sheesh, my God. Wow, but I must say that's actually one of the most interesting, and I think actually in one way plausible and healthy, you know, theories I've heard in that regard. At least, maybe not, you know, obviously we can have differences in regards to how this will become visualized and so forth, but what I definitely am seeing at this point already in a way is that the importance, if you will, of people confronting their dark side, if you will, their hidden stuff. There is other kind of astrological signs pointing to this as well, with the with the importance, if you will, of Pluto, for instance, moving through at this particular time, meaning that a lot of hidden stuff and things that we have buried, so to speak, deep inside us have to come out. They have to be exercised, processed, and in a way we have to learn to deal with it. And I think that that's a very healthy thing. And if we think about it, if we manage to get through that period, it might mean a whole new type of setting for the human being. Basically, we could end up in a whole new different situation where people aren't plagued by their demons, as it were, anymore, but we can actually start living our lives as full human beings, you know?
Yeah, it actually gives us a way of explaining how we could actually make a better world if enough people went through a change that, it will be traumatic for some people.
It will, yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But that fundamental amount of change is what is needed in order to get the world out of the mess it's in, really.
Indeed.
As regards the physical changes, some people say, you know, will there be a catastrophe? Well, if you look upon this as a process that's already started, and there's already a lot of people who have already given their lives, who've lost their lives in this process. I mean, there's hurricanes and tsunamis that have happened, and many people have already passed to the other side.
Yeah.
So, but I look upon these as the birth pangs. You know, I mean, in the birth, if we go back to that analogy of the birth process, in the old days, a birth was something that could kill the mother under certain circumstances. But I mean, the main event is the birth of a new life form, but the side effects are the pain and the mess and the terrible anguish of the actual birth process. But that all, as soon as it's over, that is all it all fades away, and the main event is there before us.
Mm. Well, I think that's a positive outlook, and I think it's a very I would certainly welcome that, if you will, you know, that kind of change and see something new. I think it's time for the next step, if you will, in human evolution, so we can make something new and something better on this planet and what we're doing right now, you know. So I would welcome it for sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, Jeff, I think that's a very good point to begin to round things up here. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show on such short notice, and it has been great having you. We're definitely looking forward to having you back again sometime if you're up for it, and keep us posted of your work, of course. But I do want you to mention your website for us again, and also, of course, mention the title of your book again, and how people can get a copy for those who are interested in reading even more and going deeper into this, of course.
Right. Well, the website is www.diagnosis2012.co.uk. That's diagnosis2012.co.uk. There's links there to the Amazon sources and to the publisher I have in the UK. It's coming out on Inner Traditions in America next year. The little book is, it's a new experiment I'm doing. You can get it on Lulu. I haven't actually got an online source for it, apart from Ian Crane's selling it on his website at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But that has just been taken on by the ARE, an American publisher, and that should be coming out in America as well next year. But they might call it the 2012 Mini Guide.
Right, and right now it's called 2012 In Your Pocket, right?
That's right.
Yes.
I've also written a little book on the Maya calendar systems. It's called The Mayan and Other Ancient Calendars. That can be found on both the Amazons as well. And it covers the Maya calendars in detail, but with some other material showing how basically the Maya calendar is superior to all the other ancient calendar systems. And it also has got some groundbreaking diagrams that shows how it explains various astronomical theories and interacts with them.
Mm, interesting. So again, the website is diagnosis2012.co.uk. Head over there, take a good look around. There's lots for you there to dive into further. And do check out those copies of the books, Beyond 2012, catastrophe or ecstasy. Thank you very much again, Jeff. Keep up the good work, and thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much, Henry.
That concludes our program with Jeff Stray. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back on Sunday with Christopher Morse from creativecosmos.org. We're going to talk about the Zen Eye of the Hurricane. I'm looking forward to another great conversation with Chris. Don't miss rediceforum.com. Talk about the recent show, pop a question, or just share some of your own findings or research. And again, I want to remind you of our live programs. You don't want to miss this. Tune in live on Sunday, the 28th at 7 p.m. GMT. We'll be talking with Daniel Tatman and dive deeper into architecture and symbolism. This is Henrik Palmgren. My thanks to Big Bro Fredrik in the control room. See you online or talk more on Sunday. Take good care of yourself.